This episode is brought to you by Essentia. A better you starts with better hydration. Essentia is on a mission to inspire people to do what matters most. Their proprietary ionization process transforms water from any source into ionized alkaline water, providing water that's 99.9% pure with a pH of 9.5 or higher. Essentia overachieving H2O, the number one ionized alkaline water. Shop now.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
This episode is brought to you by Dove. You use all the right skincare products for your face, but your body has been missing out. With new Dove Serum Body Wash, you can give your body the vitamin C glow it's been wanting, the hydration boost it's been craving, and the active skincare ingredients it deserves. It's time for your body care era. New Dove Serum Body Wash. Get Dove or get FOMO.
This is your typical radio ad while eating a Crunch Bar.
This is Automatic of Otto's Used Cars. This weekend only, we're having a whale! Bring the kids. See for yourself. It is huge. Gonna make a big splash. No other dealer can say they have a whale like this.
When things sound dull, turn up the fun with Crunch.
Hello, I'm Kellyanne Taylor, and this is the Radio Times podcast. Every week, I sit down with a celebrity guest from the world of TV or film to talk about their lives, both on and off screen. To my fellow TV enthusiasts, I hope you enjoy listening. For this special episode of the Radio Times podcast, I am joined by the conservationists Chris Packham and Megan McCubbin. Packham was born in Southampton in 1961 and spent much of his childhood exploring the nature he found at his doorstep. As a teenager with autism, he was picked on at school, and his solace was the outside world. After studying zoology at the University of Southampton, Packham found himself in the world of television and film, taking still photographs. But it was his audition for The Really Wild Show which kick-started his career. Today he is recognised as one of Britain's most prominent wildlife TV presenters. He joins the podcast alongside his stepdaughter, the conservationist and TV presenter Megan McGubbin. In this episode, we discuss the perils of activism, the everyday changes everyone can make to fight climate change, and the beauty of watching telly together. Welcome to the Radio Times podcast, and thank you so much for coming.
Thanks for having us.
Let's start off first and foremost. We always talk about the view from your sofa, so I want you to talk me through your living room setup.
Ours are very different, polar opposites.
Polar opposites. You go first.
Okay, so I live in a little cottage, kind of out in the wild, which is really nice. Quite a small sofa, and looking out, I look onto a display of feathers. Some carved out of wood, some real feathers that I've collected over the years. There's lots of skulls in my living room. There is deer skulls. I've got mountain hare, puffin skull, gannet skull.
Wow.
It's a natural history shrine.
Mm. With a collection of whiskey in the corner.
And gin. Yeah.
What about you, Chris?
No, I live in a sort of a minimalist, sort of higher tech environment that people have likened to sort of an art gallery, because I quite like modern furniture and I'm very keen on very primary colours. So I have a bright red sofa, a bright red sort of armchair that no one's allowed to sit on, but Sid the dog does. And then a couple of other pieces of furniture, which no one's allowed to sit on, but they look great. So my, you know, front room is a very different sort of place. It's a cross between a sort of a furniture showroom and a museum, and there's bits of punk rock memorabilia nailed on the wall and a record player in its own little cabinet.
And some very questionable art.
And some questionable art.
Really questionable, yeah.
Dodgy.
So you've not really spoken that much about TV. Are you big TV watchers?
Yeah, I mean, I you know, watch more TV now than I did when I was a kid. We weren't encouraged to watch much TV when I was a kid in the 1960s, but now I think I watch a bit more. And I tend to watch TV a lot more for you know, sort of relaxation. So I don't go to it so much for information. I don't watch as many documentaries as I watched when I was younger.
Oh, that's interesting.
So, yeah, no, for me, it's if I'm watching TV, mostly it's last thing at night, and that is last thing at night for me because I don't sleep very much. So very often I'll be watching at sort of 1 o'clock, 2 o'clock in the morning.
Wow.
And so for that reason, I do tend to sort of gravitate these days to more sort of drama and movies and that sort of thing. If I'm watching TV, aside from news and things like that, which are part of everyday TV. And then, of course, yesterday, Megs was driving down from her cottage in Scotland. And so when she arrived, I put on one of our favourite programmes, which is...
one of your favourite programmes.
Antiques Roadshow. So
I don't.
Meg doesn't like Antiques Roadshow.
I just don't get the hype around it. You know?
No, I'm with you.
Repair shop, yes. Antiques Roadshow, not much my thing. Not more my
thing. See, I call the repair shop the despair shop because everyone's always so sad when
there's
they come
a lot
in.
Of sob stories.
And I find that quite heartbreaking. So what I like about the Antiques Roadshow is it's a bit of a lucky dip. You never know what they're going to find and you never know whether it's going to be something that might interest you. I'm more interested in the art than the watches, for instance. And although sometimes the stories about the medals are fascinating because they're very personal to the participants, the people that brought them along. And then every now and again, you know, something remarkable will turn up. And of course, you've always got the opportunity to sort of guess the value of the Rolex. I mean, you know, I have no idea about watches. So, you know, I'd be sitting there saying, well, that probably kind of 100 quid looks a bit ropey to me, a bit scratched, found down the back of a sofa somewhere. And then, of course, they say it's £20,000.
And you think, whoa.
Yeah. So I quite like that. But not as much as my favourite programme, which is Fake or Fortune.
Okay, I'm very surprised by your TV habits.
I love Fake or Fortune. It's absolutely got all the ingredients. I've got a really keen interest in art. I really like Philip Mould and Fiona. I think they work brilliantly together. Philip's a great, you know, raconteur. He's the expert. He leads the whole thing. Fiona's there as the inquisitor. And then it's got all the science, obviously, because they're investigating these, often with quite advanced scientific techniques. And then you've always got, you're on the edge of your seat, is it or isn't it, by that famous artist. And that's critical, of course, for the owners. And, I just think they're really, really well made. It's gripping. I've watched them all, every single one, on catch up.
Do you have similar taste?
No.
Okay. What was the last thing that you watched and you enjoyed?
Last thing I watched was The Doghouse on Channel 4.
Oh, I've not seen.
Oh my God. If you want a heartwarming, beautiful show, you watch The Doghouse. It will pick you up.
What's it about?
It's a dating show for dogs, pretty much. So it's like people who want to adopt a dog and rehome a dog, they go in, I think it's Greenwood Dog Rescue Centre, and they basically get paired with the dog of their dreams based on personality, not based on breed. So a lot of the time people go and choose like, okay, I want a Labrador, I want a poodle. This isn't that case. This is okay, I need a dog to fit in with this type of lifestyle. And they match you with a dog and you go on a little dog date and it's just the most heartwarming, beautiful thing ever.
Okay, I'm sold.
Yeah, no, trust me.
More than Fake or Fortune, I have to admit. I'm very sorry.
Yeah.
And when you watch TV together, do you have similar tastes?
Well, I think we kind of meet in the middle, don't we? We kind of find a common ground because I grew up on a lot of horror, scary, zombie, action-packed sci-fi films. So, you know, like The Shining, Blair Witch Project. I mean, I was watching those when I was five.
All right, don't tell everyone that.
Well, I was. I loved it.
Desensitise you to hyper-violence at a young age.
And it worked. No, but we do. We watch stuff together, don't we? We watch zombie films quite a lot of the time. Yep. They're a big fan.
I didn't do Game of Thrones until about series four. I had to catch up because you were into it. You kept saying to me, didn't you?
Yeah.
You're going to like this. You're going to like it. And I was thinking, oh, sort of fantasy. And eventually we sat down and then we were gripped and we watched it together, didn't we?
It's a brilliant series to watch.
Yeah. I rewatched it again with Chris. You have to, trust me, dragons, fighting, unpredictable moments. It's a time commitment, but it's worth it. So no, we do tend to kind of have common ground.
But there are
the
things that you will skulk off to and watch on your own.
Yeah.
You have to hide in the bedroom with the door closed to be able to watch in my house.
Yeah, I know, because I won't hear the end of it otherwise. And also, sometimes it's good when you're in an art deco house, but you're not allowed to sit on any chairs. Sometimes you have to escape to your
own to have some comfort.
Yeah, to watch like Love Island.
No.
What is it?
No.
Then? What is it?
Okay, well, the guilty pleasure at the minute. Married at First Sight Australia.
Everyone is talking about this. I can't commit to it because I think I will end up down that rabbit hole.
But my partner, not into reality shows at all, I can't watch it without him now. He's there shouting at the shouting at the TV. So it's so gripping, and Australia's better because Australians can be just brutal with the drama. Australia is better, I think, than Married at First Sight.
It's dialed up, okay.
Because it's like Australians are just like sassy.
Yeah.
And I love it. and it's brutal, but sometimes it's heartfelt and heartwarming. But Married at First Sight for me.
Is it?
It's your guilty pleasure.
But yeah. Not for you.
I have no idea what you're talking about.
Well, you can watch an episode later if you want.
No, do you know what? I've got one to catch up on. I think I'll probably skip it.
Are you sure?
Yeah,
you're not a fan of reality TV?
No, I don't, actually. No. The thing is, TV's a lot of commitment. You're going to give it a lot of hours. It's like a book, isn't it? You know, if you pick up a book, you're going to give a certain percentage of your life to reading that book. So you've got to make the right choice. And if you're not sure that you can make the right choice, then it's hard to take that, you know, that decision to start watching it. And what I do find with quite a few of the dramas that I start watching is that if they're moving too slowly, I lose interest pretty quick.
Yeah.
So, and I won't complete them. I'll just let them go. I just sort of think that I'm not getting the reward that I need for this, you know. So there were some dramas that I would stick through. I liked Dark, that sci-fi that was made for Netflix. It's a German one. And the production values are really high. It's a convoluted sort of time travel saga. And I really get into that. I get hooked in pretty much like the same way you got hooked with Game of Thrones. There's always a story going on that you haven't quite got to the answer of what's going to happen. So you want to know that next time around. It was a bit like that. But some of the sort of Nordic noir things that I try to watch, I get bored after episode two and just give up.
Well, also, it is a lot of concentration, isn't it?
But I feel like if you've invested a couple hours, I'm like, oh, I've got to see it through. Even if I'm not enjoying it, I feel like it's a waste of time prior. So then I'll just carry on, even if I'm not enjoying, which is probably not the right thing to do.
What about radio? Do you listen to the radio? Do you have a favourite programme or a favourite podcast?
So I've got to be honest with you, I only listen to one channel. And it's on, I have it on in the car, and I'll listen, and I don't listen to any drama, but I'll listen to their documentaries and news, and that's Radio 4. So I'm a complete Radio 4 head. I like the Today programme in the morning. I wake up with that, I listen to that. I think it's best quality news that you can get at that time of the day, no question. Good, you know, reporting, good interviewers. And then I like their documentaries, and particularly the things they do on history. So if I don't hear them there, then I'll catch them up on BBC Sounds.
Absolutely. What about you, Megan?
Not much of a radio head, to be honest. I mean, Nature's Table, Radio 4. I like that show. That's very good, as you might have guessed. but otherwise, no, I don't listen to much radio. When I'm driving, I typically have a podcast or an audiobook on now. So I've kind of moved off in that direction as opposed to having radio on in the background.
Yeah.
But I need news. I need daily news updates. So that's the key thing. So, you know, and news takes time as much as everything else does. So, I wake up quite early. I put the, Today programme on. By the time I get out of bed, I've got the highlights, if you know what I mean.
Can we cast it back to childhood now and tell me what your first ever TV memory was?
We watched a lot of The Simpsons.
Simpsons for you, probably.
I mean, we had poodles for a while called Itchy and Scratchy, named after, obviously, The Simpsons characters. So The Simpsons was quite big, wasn't it?
It was.
Growing up.
Yeah.
What else did we have?
TV-wise. I mean, there were lots of films. So in order to sort of regulate what Megs could watch, we bought a small television which would take VHS cassettes. So I would get the VHS cassettes and give them, and you'd watch those films. So I gave you a lot of historical films. You loved Spartacus, do you remember?
Loved Spartacus.
The Vikings.
Yeah.
Love that. And then I also gave you one which was called, what was it called? It wasn't Camelot, was it? It was King Arthur, I think. And I gave it to you, and I sort of vaguely remembered it. But you were into all of that sort of swords and sandals and sword fights and princesses and all that stuff.
Yeah, Princess Bride. That was a great
Princess
film.
We loved that. So good. Yeah. The Screaming Eels.
Screaming Eels was great.
Screaming Eels. The sword fight at the top of the cliff. Oh, so good. Anyway, look, I gave you this one with King Arthur in it. And I didn't think any more about it, but you became obsessed by it, and you were watching it back to back, and you just rerun it. And then Mum went in, and what I had forgotten, that there was a particularly erotic scene in
No.
Yeah. Do you remember?
Yeah, but hang on, I was watching Blair Witch at that point, so I'm sure I could handle a sex scene.
But nevertheless,
we
were trying to regulate what you were watching, so you weren't watching anything inappropriate, and I'd given you this film with this sort of very sort of, you know, heavy scene in it. Anyway.
There's nothing worse than when you're watching something and then suddenly that comes on and everyone in the room is thinking,
oh,
yeah.
Oh, let's just, shall I make a cup of tea?
Yeah. It's when you're with your parents.
Yes.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches, but there's only one McCrispy. So go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
Do you have weak, damaged hair? New Garnier Fructis hair filler systems fill hair with strength 7 layers deep. In just one use, you can reverse up to 1 year of damage to hair smoothness.
the sulfate-free hair filler plus vitamin CG system gives you up to 79% stronger hair and up to 4 times less breakage. New Garnier Fructis hair filler is available now on Amazon and at Walmart, Target, Ulta, Drug, and select grocery stores.
This episode is brought to you by PNC Bank, who believes some things in life should be boring, like banking, because boring is steady, pragmatic, responsible. You don't want your bank to be cool or sexy. Sexy is for red carpets, not banks. That's why PNC Bank strives to be boring with your money, so you can be happily fulfilled with your life. PNC Bank, brilliantly boring since 1865. Brilliantly boring since 1865 is a service mark of the PNC Financial Services Group, Inc. PNC Bank, National Association, member FDIC.
Okay, let's talk about when you first get into nature, because I'm asking you about TV, but I imagine that a lot of your childhoods actually were spent outside and in the wilderness. So when do you first get this inkling that you're obsessed with nature or you really enjoy the outdoors?
Well, for me, it was before we probably had a TV, because, again, we grew up in the 60s, so our TVs were rented and they were black and white. I mean, you know, and there were 3 channels. Initially, probably there were only 2 channels. But by that stage, I was outside crawling about, looking for this, that and the other, catching lizards and snakes and smuggling them into my bedroom. So, you know, for me, it was very nature came first. And my parents would try to get me into sort of watching nature programs, which, you know, if people cast their mind back, was Animal Magic with Johnny Morris. But I was a terrible snob. And Johnny Morris would sort of do animal voices, very anthropomorphic. And I didn't like that. I was really snobby about it. Well, no, I can't watch that. It's ridiculous. This man makes up voices for the animals. They don't talk. And that was just me being 6 and 7. So I'd watched quite a lot of documentaries, you know, Chronicle, Horizon. I loved all of that. And history documentaries. I remember The Ascent of Man, watching that. Carl Sagan obviously was just like a legend in our house, you know, so we watched that. But no, you're right. Most of the time, if I could be outside, I was outside.
Yeah. And what about you, Megan?
Yeah, to be honest, very similar.
And was it Chris's influence as well?
I mean, it definitely had some influence. Of course it did. But yeah, I mean, I met Chris when I was 2 and very much had a childhood outdoors. You know, we were quite lucky where we lived in Southampton that I had quite a big garden. There's a stream at the end and I was always convinced that the fairies lived at the bottom of the stream as monks as other wildlife. And we had badgers, we had everything. And so many animals living inside the house as well, not just poodles, but also, you know, I had praying mantids, I had hamsters, I had tarantulas, snakes. You know, there was a barn owl in the downstairs bathroom when I came home from school one time. So wildlife was very much out of the house in the garden, but also inside the house. So it's just like part and parcel of growing up. Like, I didn't know any different. And I was very lucky that I got to, you know, volunteer my time at a wildlife sanctuary as I grew up.
On Saturdays, you used to go down there, didn't you?
Yeah. I did Brent Lodge Wildlife Hospital. I used to volunteer there, and getting older, doing more and more volunteering. But obviously, I grew up in a time where, you know, the Really Wild Show had been on. I used to watch, I think, again, that tape what do you call it? A tape player? God, that's just my age. I never used video players anymore.
So it's back in the dark ages.
Back in the dark ages.
Prehistory, thanks.
Exactly. Puppet show. But no, we're watching kind of the recordings of Really Wild Show with Chris and Michaela, where they would exchange envelopes and go off around the world to see animals. You know, David Attenborough, of course, as well, was, you know, doing his thing, as he still is. So I got my nature fixed that way. And there was a great kids show, wasn't there, with a gecko.
Gordon the Gecko.
And it was this little green gecko that would come on and he would talk to you, but he would like tell you all about animals. So I used to watch that quite a lot. So, when it wasn't The Simpsons, it was kind of this
Gordon the Gecko.
Or I was out and about actually trying to find geckos.
Yeah. So how do you pivot into TV? Did that feel like a world that was accessible to you?
It was an accident. I mean, from my point of view, completely. It's something I'd never thought about. And I'd made up my mind at age 13 that I wanted to stay in the academic system. And then when I got to 23, I realised it wasn't really for me. I couldn't make that work for myself. I was with great sadness that I left. And I actually started working for a cameraman who was making one of the Attenborough series at the time.
Oh, wow.
As an assistant. And I just needed money to take still photos, which I still take. And so I sort of got this job to pay for sort of, you know, the travel and the film. And then I started to sort of make films of my own for the BBC. But that was few and far between. You know, when you're a young cameraman, you don't get constant work, very obviously. You know, you need to build up your experience. So, and then I just needed some money. I was on and off the dole the whole time. And I went for an audition for the Really Wild Show. And And that's how I started. And but it wasn't something I ever thought about doing. It was something that I sort of really drifted towards. And even when I'd started The Really Wild Show, I carried on the camera work for 2 or 3 years.
Wow, just to keep your foot in that door or to make
sure. I didn't know what I was going to do. And it was quite difficult for me. I'd been at university, and then I'd been working with this one guy who was the cameraman, and I hadn't been working in a team of people, and I sort of was struggling to sort of socialise. And so when I started Really Wild Show, I had to sort of two jobs at once. I had to sort of train myself to work in a team of people because I didn't normally communicate with teams of people. And then also obviously learn to be a TV presenter. And, to no discredit to anyone, I never got any training. There isn't any training. You just turn up.
Learn on the job.
You do your best and you watch the VHS tapes that your mum's made for you when you go around their house and you think, oh, God, I did that terribly. I've got to improve this. I've got to do this differently and so on and so forth. So it was a sort of teach yourself.
When I was doing my research, I learned that you had embraced punk rock whilst you were at university. Mm. And I wondered how your punk rock days have stayed with you, if there was anything that you learned during that period about yourself or the way of life.
Yeah, no. So that was when I was 16, so before university. And it's had a profound and very positive impact on my life. And because a lot of people thought it was about music and that it was about anger and anarchy and spitting and everything else that was in the tabloid headlines. But in fact, it was about an attitude. And the attitude was about not taking no for an answer, and underlying everything was a do it yourself. You know, there was no X factor. If you wanted to be in a band, you had to scrounge some money to get a guitar, find a lock up to practice in, write some songs about girlfriends you never had, and then play in the local pub, and then try and work your way up the poster. No one came in and made you a rock star.
Yeah.
And it was very much about that, and it was about, it was a very angry period, the mid-70s, and we also learned to turn our anger into something creative. That was what it was. So it didn't matter whether it was fashion, art, music, and in my case, you know, science. You know, I learned to turn that anger into something positive. And I'm very proud to say that I am an old punk rocker. I am just as defiant and just as ready to question authority and to do things myself, not wait for other people to do them, just get on and do them myself. And that stems very much from that very formative period. So I was very lucky, I think, that someone with my sort of mental disposition happened to coincide with that whole thing breaking in 1976-77.
And Megan, can we talk a bit about how you got into TV?
Yeah, of course. So sort of similar to Chris in terms of, like, I'd never pictured that for myself or imagined that would be a possibility. It never really occurred to me. I never really believed that I could be a scientist, particularly at school. I wasn't very good at science. I'm dyslexic. I really struggled academically with it. And then I kind of had to, luckily I had support, you know, from Chris and my other family members who noticed the issue and got me the dyslexic support that I needed. So I learned how I learn, and now I realised that it's not necessarily the fact that I can't do things. It's just that I think and learn differently to other people. So I had to recognise that in myself and teach myself science. So I got the confidence and studied zoology at university and thought that would probably be it. I'd probably go off and work in some far-flung region of the earth, researching hyena communication or, like, sharks. I was always really interested in predators.
Yes, yeah.
Really interested in predators. And I was working out in China for a charity called Animals Asia, who I just think are brilliant. They still do some fantastic work. So I was a bear behavioural specialist volunteer. And I was out there for 3 or 4 months, came back, and a friend of ours who works at the BBC was working on a series called Undercover Tourist, which was how close tourists could get to the illegal wildlife trade without noticing it. And they had a story fall through, and they were panicked because, the series was going to air. They needed something for the final episode, and they didn't know what to do. And I was like, well, have you thought about bear bile farming in Asia? And they were like, oh no, what's that about? I hadn't heard of it, and I explained what it was. I've just got back, and next thing I know, a couple of weeks later, I was in the middle of university. I had to take a week out of university to go to Vietnam to film this documentary, and then that was the start of it. And then I worked for Al Jazeera for a bit. Chris and I then started Self-Isolating Bird Club in lockdown. And then I was thrown in the deep end of live television for Springwatch. Yes. which
quite like that.
Which was mad. But it was never like a career path I thought possible. And I still, even now, I'm like, really? Am I doing this? I'm loving it.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's you kind of pinch yourself sometimes.
I had no idea about the bear bile industry.
Yeah.
And I was really interested in, both of you have done work around conservationism which I guess at times, especially from an outside perspective, can seem quite dangerous, or you can be putting yourself at risk. Also, when you are very outspoken about environmental issues, you do have people online posting, often threatening as well. How have you handled that side of the job? And both of you work in very similar things as a stepfather, but also seeing it towards Chris as well. How have you navigated that?
Well, I mean, Mex came out to, we'd started doing something with a lady called Ruth Peacey, and I were going out to Malta. And this is about illegal bird hunting in the Mediterranean. And we'd gone on to Cyprus, where things are quite heavy, you know, and you've got to be really careful with it. If you get caught by these people, they're not going to let you go without a good beating. And, you know, Megs came out there and we were working with Ruth, and the situation can be sort of quite hectic and volatile. But look, you know, we don't tend to think about that, I don't think. We think about the issue and what we have to do to make things right. So you tend to put those sorts of things to the back of your mind, you know. And again, you know, the bear bile people aren't particularly friendly either. So there's many of these situations where large sums of money involved and a lot of vested interest and they don't want to change. And we're trying to change them more rapidly than they even want to think about. So there's always going to be pushback. And I think you get that online as well. I mean, that is our biggest problem. You know, we know that we have to change our practices and our minds, but people are reluctant to do so. And a tiny percentage of those people tend to lash out, whether it's on social media or you're in a field in Cyprus and someone's waving a big iron bar at you. You know, it's that's part and parcel of the job, really. And you can't allow that to intimidate you, you know, because we're on a mission and we think that mission is right. And we've got to do whatever we can as individuals and with the people that we work with to see that through. So you just can't allow those sorts of threats to intimidate you. And in fact, if I'm honest with you, from my point of view, they spur me on to do more. You know, if people threaten me or they damage my property or threaten to damage me, I just think, like, do you know what? I'm going to get up earlier tomorrow. I'm going to work even harder to change what you're doing that's wrong, you know.
I think when you're, like, confronted with, you know, animal welfare issues, like, you know, birds in Malta being shot, caught in lime sticks, mist nets, and you know, you see some terrible things firsthand. The bears, for example, that, you know, some of those images will remain in my mind forever. And a lot of the time, like that, it's hard for people to watch on a documentary, but to actually be there and see it in person is a very different thing. But I think when you're in those kind of situations, you're so motivated by what you're seeing and thinking, nobody knows about this issue. If I'm not here to report it and document it, then this is never going to change. Mm-hmm. In 10, 15, 20 years' time, these bears are still going to be here. These birds are still going to be getting caught. And the issue's going to go on and if not get worse. And as the biodiversity crisis gets worse, that's going to become more catastrophic. Mm. So if I'm not here doing it, then who else is? And you kind of, you know, when you get home, you can deal with, you know, what you've seen, process that and all of that kind of stuff. But when you're there, it's like, God, I'm doing something. God, I'm doing something. And you feel good that you're not just sat at home, you know, worried. Because for me, it's better to be on the ground and actually trying to change something than at home worrying about, you know, the future of the planet. So there's that element of, you know, the direct implications. I mean, the stuff online, you're always, like Chris said, you're always going to get something when you're trying to change people's mindsets. And I think the closer you get to that transition, the change flipping to the good side, is when people are going to push back even more and you're going to get, you know, harsher threats. You know, Chris has had his gates burned down and we've had, you know, animals left at the front door. It sounds really bad because you should never get desensitized to it. But I think over time we probably have a little bit too much. But I mean, it means you're making some headway, right? It means you're ruffling the right feathers.
My friend Billy Bragg says, if you're not getting flack, you're not over the target. And I think you've got to accept that. You know, if people are writing nasty things about you, it's because you've challenged them. And that's our job sometimes, is to challenge people, to get them to think. That's what it's about. We're trying to get people to have a conversation, either broadly or with themselves, so that they can run through a process where they come out the other side and think, okay, I've got to change what I'm doing. And that's what we're asking. But then again, I suppose there are other issues when there's no ambiguity about the fact that it's illegal, so the bird killing in Cyprus and Malta, for instance, then, you're not asking people to change there. You're trying to get the law upheld. So you're trying to get evidence. You're working closely with the police to try to get them onto the site. You're trying to push through prosecutions and so on and so forth. And, of course, that just, again, brings you into conflict. I've got to say on the other side, just to be very honest with you, that you always get a bit of a buzz about it as well. you know, the closer you are when you're hiding in the dark in a bush.
Oh, my God, there's no feeling quite in Cyprus.
I mean, you're kind of terrified. But, yeah. Because if they catch you, you're in deep trouble. You know, they're, like I say, they're not going to let you off without a good beating, or they're going to strip all your clothes off, or they're going to smash your car up and throw away the keys. I mean, it's not going to go well. But when you're there in the bushes, in the dark, and you can hear these people moving around, you've got to wait for them to go, and then you're going to, you know, get their mist nets and everything else like that. It is actually very...
It's adrenaline, isn't it?
It's exciting, yeah.
It's an adrenaline thing.
We need people to do it. And also, like you said, you mentioned this earlier, Megan, when we were chatting upstairs about the importance of, say, for example, this issue of the Radio Times. Mm. It's not only about speaking to people who already agree. It's by showing and highlighting the way forward of changes we should all make, because it impacts each and every one of us.
Exactly.
And that's so fundamental. And I wonder if... Actually, you know, for example, my mum loves the watches. This is like her favourite time of year when it's on. For you guys, that's given you almost a platform as well. It's something that's beloved by the nation, and it allows you to connect with people who love nature but maybe aren't necessarily doing anything about the massive climate crisis that we're suffering right now. For you guys, how has that journey been, and how has it been working together?
Yeah, I mean, I think the first thing is that, you know, the watches are about, they've got an important job to do. And it's not campaign, and it's not go on about all the bad news. It's to get people to love their wildlife.
Mm.
And that's what the wildlife of the watches is about. It's not rare. It's not in other parts of the world. It's not particularly fancy. It's about blackbirds and blue tits. And these are the species that people share their community with. And they genuinely love them. And our job is to enhance that affinity so that when there's a crisis outside of those programs, we can go to those people and say, look, we need your help, basically. Mm-hmm. And they won't help you if they don't love it. And if they love it and they fear losing it, then there's a much greater chance that they'll come on board and help you with those campaigns. So they have an important role to play, and we understand what that is. But you're right. I mean, you know, what this issue is about is taking that next step. This is saying to people, look, you know, you've got to do something yourself. You've got to recognise that you've got to empower yourself to make a difference. You and your voice count. Every single one of our voices counts, particularly young people. It's important that we get that message across to those young people. And that's one of the reasons why I've tried to get as many young contributors to this issue as possible. And ultimately, is I think for me, one of the key things is the way that we frame things. People can be intimidated by an existential crisis like climate breakdown and think, oh, I can't possibly have any impact on that. It's just the whole global thing. It's
just one person. What can I do?
What can I do? Yeah. What can I do? You know, and so what we've got to do is we've got to present people not with problems, right, which they can't overcome, but with opportunities which they can enjoy. And I think that that's the way that we've got to change our messaging. You know, we've got to say to them, look, you know, you may, you know, see this as an, you've got to change the way you eat. You've got to change the way we eat. We all know we've got to change the way we've got to eat less meat. That's it. That's the bottom line. There's no doubt about it whatsoever. It's not me banging on as a vegan. It's a fact. The UN say that. Climate Change Committee, Government Health Department says that. Okay. Now, to some people, like eating meat. So they see that as a problem. But if we rephrase that and say, well, actually, it's not a problem. It's an opportunity for you to try eating plant-based foods, which can be really tasty, really, healthy, and also much better for the environment and animal welfare. So all of a sudden, that's not so much of a problem. Actually, that's a win-win-win-win situation. And you don't have to do it every day. But if you just do it from time to time and try it.
Yeah.
You know, that's the way that we sort of instigate that transition.
And if we all work together on it, you know, even if you can't commit to giving it up 100%, if you reduce your intake to consuming plant-based products 90% of the time, and then that 10%, that's going to make a huge difference if everyone does that.
It's a transition. I mean, even if you have like one plant-based meal a week and then the next week you have, oh, I quite like that, I'll have two.
Yeah.
It's about stepping that up. It's not about saying, okay, you have to go cold turkey on, you know, driving your diesel car. Mm. You have to go cold turkey, like eating meat, whatever it may be. It's about that transition, just starting somewhere. If you do something different tomorrow from how you did it today or yesterday, then you're winning and we're starting to go up. But it's just about everyone doing that together and starting for what's reasonable and you know, available to them.
Yeah, absolutely. What has it been like guest editing the Radio Times?
it was a lot more. So again, I can't half do something. If I did explain this to Shona when she said, "Would I like to guest edit?" I said, "Well, I can do it, but you know, I only accept it if it's a proper job, and you know, I can't just sort of make a phone call and then look at the cover and say, oh, that's nice." So I think I probably sort of had, you know, as much input as I could, and I, you know, we've constantly been discussing how we can make it the most positive thing. So we want to include things which are challenging for people to promote conversations, but there's always a takeout. There's always something at the end which they can do to make that difference, and so that was important. So I've reached out to as many of my sort of contacts as I possibly could, and you know, and fellow campaigners and so forth. And the team have been brilliant, absolutely brilliant. They've soaked it all up, and we've negotiated a truce over a couple of things. But you know, it's been really, really good. I've enjoyed that process, and I hope they have too. I just sort of threw myself into it and took over. But as I said, you know, that's the way I needed it to count for something. Mm. I'm not someone who does something for cosmetic reasons. You know, it's very nice and I'm very flattered to be on the cover of Radio Times, but that's not going to be the deal for me. The content is when you open those pages and people can take out something which will be positive in their lives and positive for the environment.
I look after feedback sometimes, which is a section of the magazine where our readers write in. And like you say, the reason why we put that magazine together every week is because of the reaction it has. And we have a really strong community. And actually, the last time I was looking after it, it was just after you'd had your BBC documentary. And it was so overwhelming, the number of emails and letters that we had in from people basically saying that you'd highlighted through this documentary Inside Our Autistic Minds, opened up to our readers an entire new world, or explained how people work and all of this neurodiversity and the importance of that and the beauty of it. And it was really overwhelming, the number of emails we got that week just on this specific documentary and the impact it had on them. And I wonder, obviously you guys both contribute massively to nature and the documentaries on that side, but actually how was it turning the lens on something maybe a bit more personal?
Well, I'm fortunate to have a small voice because of the media work that I do, and I have to use that voice for good. Mm. And I have to use that voice for good in terms of environmental campaigning, and also, of course, for helping people who may be struggling with their neurodiversity. I can't just go home and turn it off. It's just not the person that I am. You know, I do these things because there's a vocational drive to do that. And I had a really horrible time as a teenager and through the early part of my 20s. It was particularly difficult. And I just don't like the idea of other young people out there, you know, in the state that I was in. And so if we can generate a broader understanding of neurodiversity and all of those conditions they're in, then the world could and should be an easier place for them to prosper and succeed and have a fulfilled life, you know. And so, yeah, when we make those programs, obviously we address, you know, the disabling aspects of those conditions, but also we make sure that we focus on the enabling aspects of those conditions as well, because I think we've got to say, particularly again to young people, that I mean, there were days when there was no tunnel, let alone any light at the end of it for me. And we've got to say, look, there is a tunnel and there is light at the end of that tunnel. And there are, you know, there are support. There's support there for you. And you've got to reach out for it. And this is how you use it and access it. And part of that support has got to come from society, which has to be more understanding of neurodiverse people and their everyday needs. And that was the mission of the program. And it was, you know, amazing that so many people responded positively to that. And so from my point of view, it was, again, a privilege to be part of a team who made a really, you know, good piece of public service broadcasting. I think we did a public service with that to a community of people that sometimes struggle. So, as I said, enormous privilege to be a part of that.
What was that like to create together?
It was great fun, actually.
Yeah, you know, enjoyed it.
It was good. I mean, we the whole premise was that it was kind of just after lockdown when everyone was going on road trips. Mm. So we decided we'd go on a road trip as well. But we had a focus on natural history. We want to go and see wildlife. We want to go to really interesting cultural places. We did it all in an electric van. So we nice. Drove around. We went 50-50 on a playlist, which was...
difficult.
No, come on. It was fine. But it was great fun. You know, we got to see some places of the UK that I'd never been to before, some places that Chris hadn't been to, and you know, surprised each other with various things. I mean, we did the longest zip line to fly like a peregrine and like silly things like that. But it was, we have quite a lot of fun working together. It's never a dull moment.
No. I think it's an asset, really, because, you know, if you have that sort of underlying understanding, then you know how far you can push someone. You know what they think is funny and what they don't think is funny. and you know what they know. And then just by looking at them, you know that, you know, you've said enough and they should do the talking from there on. And it's that sort of intuitive thing that makes it really comfortable. And I'd love to do more work with Meg. So I think it's, you know, and also the other things, it's sometimes easier if you're sharing something with someone else in that moment, it's easier to communicate that to the viewer, basically, because they can see a sort of a mutual joy ricocheting between two people. Whereas if it's just yourself, you're trying to ricochet that between you and the audience, the audience through the lens of the camera. And that can be sometimes a little bit trickier. And for us, sometimes, you know, it is making sure that we communicate that joy. We are in those moments and we are generally elated and euphoric because we've been put somewhere where, you know, we just really want to be, and we're looking at what we really want to see or hear or smell or feel, you know. And what we're saying to the audience is, you know, do it yourself. Mm-hmm. Come and stand where we're standing. And that was our mission in that program, wasn't it? Everywhere we went was publicly accessible. So, you know, we was just saying, you know, follow in our footsteps and you'll see what we see.
Yeah, you know, come and see these otters on this canoe, or go and, you know, the red kite feeding stations.
Oh,
amazing. And like we went to a pub which had badgers in the garden. Mm. You know, it was work. It was a job, but we had a really wonderful time.
Well, that's it. I think we don't always appreciate how much we have just here on our doorstep.
No.
But thank you so much for coming on the Radio Times podcast.
That's a pleasure.
Time. Thank you.
It's a pleasure. And do enjoy our Earth Day special.
I hope you enjoyed this special episode of the Radio Times podcast. I'll be back soon for a brand new series. Keep your ears peeled. Until then, do go back and enjoy all our archived episodes, including interviews with Dame Emma Thompson, David Tennant, Stephen Fry, Joanna Lumley, Olivia Colman, Lily Allen, Andy Oliver, Ramesh Ranganathan, Richard Curtis, and many, many more. Thank you for listening to the Radio Times podcast with me, your host, Kellyanne Taylor. Please do follow, rate, and review wherever you get your podcast from. It helps other TV and film lovers find us. Until next Tuesday, happy viewing. We'll